Hey, guys. hey, guys. How's things? Good, good. Well, welcome to the show. I admit I did kind of a lazy job arranging guests for today because there's so much stuff that I want to talk about myself, and I'm very selfish. I need that time. And also, I don't know, man. I just couldn't think of who I wanted to interview. I guess I could have called Gareth, but I figured I'd let him off the hook. Poor guy. Why should he have to answer my questions every time he writes something? It's like a death sentence. Nah, it's like a pain in the ass, though, probably. Yeah. It's Friday, right? I'm gonna let him off the hook. But James Corden is gonna be on the show, and I'm really glad about that because James Corden, I like that guy. I don't know too much about him, actually, now that I think about it. But I've read some things by him in the National Interest and about Ukraine that have been really good. And now I'm trying to remember if I've read anything by him that he wrote anywhere else. Oh, here he is in the American Conservative, too. I think the National Interest is where he writes. It's another, I think, fairly conservative, realist type magazine and online publication. Ukraine Exposed. Kiev's Authoritarianism. I think that's his latest. Oh, no, that's not his latest. Ukraine's Bloody Civil War, No End in Sight is the latest there. That's from March 31st. And you know what? There was something brand new by him. I got to put him in Google News here. Anyway, but check this out. He's put together an organization pushing for peace. It's called the American Committee for East-West Accord. And they got a whole mission statement here and everything, and it's all about nipping this Cold War in the bud before it gets worse. Stephen F. Cohen, Jack Matlock, Bill Bradley, huh? That's interesting. I wonder what's his record on NATO expansion from the 90s when he was a senator. Remember him? Bill Bradley ran against Al Gore in the primaries in 2000, former senator. Gilbert Doctorow, I don't know about him. Ellen Miskowitz. Oh, Jack Matlock, I could have mentioned. He was the second to last ambassador to the Soviet Union under H.W. Bush. Interviewed him a couple of times on the show about all this. William J. Vandenhuevel. I don't know if that's any relation to Katrina Vandenhuevel from The Nation magazine, editor of The Nation, who is Stephen F. Cohen's wife. But anyway, so that's a good start, and they really need to get, and this is part of what I'll talk with James Corden about, and I believe that James Corden himself is a conservative. Former State Department advisor, contributing editor at The National Interest and at The American Conservative. I believe that he is a conservative, and I would like to, of course, emphasize to him that, like, man, you got to get maybe not Pat if he's a little too radioactive, which is stupid, but whatever. But get right-wingers, man. Get as many right-wingers as you can and as prom as you can. Go find, you know, if you can get Dick Lugar or Sam Nunn still alive, find some of these old – wasn't Sam Nunn a Republican? Find old get Kissinger and Schultz. They're kind of anti-nuclear. Well, they've been real bad on the Iran deal lately, both of those guys. But Kissinger has said reasonable things about Russia. And I know that sounds horrible and evil to say, hey, get Kissinger on your thing. But hey, man, if you can have a consensus led by conservatives saying, hey, let's not have a Cold War with Russia. We're the ones starting it this time. Let's all back off. It's the right thing to do. Then that could be huge. And it's probably the only thing that has a chance of success, really. Because, you know, if it's just The Nation magazine crying about it, then who cares, right? They always were on Stalin's side. Not always, but some of the time. So, yeah, man, you got to attack the right from the right, especially on an issue like Russia. You know? Anyway, so that's really great. The American Committee for the East-West Accord. It's eastwestaccord.com. Maybe your great uncle is a former Republican senator. Call him, poke him with a stick, and tell him, hey, you're a former Republican senator. Sign on to this thing. You never know who people know, man. Anyway, so that's coming up. James Carden on the show. Sorry for tapping my pen so much. I bet that's annoying. And then, so I guess I'll save the rest of the Ukraine discussion for when he shows up. And now, Lester Bauer. I'm sorry I forgot to mention this yesterday. They did execute him on Wednesday night. Unbelievable, man. And I guess, yeah, you know, believable and everything, but I just talked with Jordan Smith on the show, writer for the Austin Chronicle, investigative reporter, formerly, for the Austin Chronicle for years and years, now writing for The Intercept at firstlook.org/The Intercept, Jordan Smith. And, hey, man, there's reasonable doubt here. But the problem is, reasonable doubt is not the standard after you've been convicted. You got to fit just the right loopholes. Like, there's been a new scientific discovery that will allow us to examine evidence in a way we weren't able to before, that we would like to have a chance to do that, Judge. Something like that. Or, you know, not even necessarily a confession. Remember the story, and she mentions this in her original article, the story where the lawyer fell asleep during the trial, and that was not in dispute. But the appeals court said, doesn't matter, or it might matter, but the burden of proof is on you to show that if only he had been awake at that moment, that somehow you would have been acquitted. But we say it seems to us like you'd have been convicted anyway. And so you're not necessarily guaranteed under the Constitution the right to have a defense attorney who stays awake during your entire trial. That ain't enough of a technicality to get a new trial. Never mind getting set free, right? We're talking about getting a new trial. And in this case, you've got a lady who says she's the wife of one of the murderers. Another lady who says she's the former girlfriend of one of the murderers. And they agree on who did it. And they agree on why. It was a drug deal gone wrong. And meanwhile, the motive for this guy, Lester Bauer, that they executed for this crime, absolutely fails to hold up whatsoever. And his stupid lies are easily explained away why he lied. And what he ended up admitting to doesn't come anywhere near a real case for murder. Or I don't know, maybe that's not true. Actually, as Jordan Smith said, you know what? If this was all you had and you were on the jury, you might say, okay, man, it sure looks like it to me. But now we've got all this more evidence coming forward. And, but oh well, too late, he's dead. And I love all this crap about, well, I'll see you in heaven when you get there. No, dude, you're dead now. That's it. You know, that reminds me of, like, tying a rock to the accused's chest and throwing them in the water. If they can swim and get away anyway somehow, then obviously they have the magical powers of the devil. But if they sink and die, then don't worry, they had a good Christian death, and they'll live forever at God's right hand, and so it's all right. No problem. Anyway. Well, there you go. So, Texas, again, executes another guy who most probably was innocent. And you could see why the cops decided to make a case against him, but that was good enough for a jury. I guess that's all that really matters, right? That should be the name of a band. Good enough for a jury. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back. All right, so this should have gone in the original segment there. I'll try to dispense with it fairly quickly, but did you see the latest on Dennis Hastert? Sister of a dead guy comes out, says Coach Hastert was molesting and raping her teenage brother for years. For years, the former Speaker of the House of Representatives, throughout apparently this kid's entire time in high school. I'm not suspicious of my son's wrestling coach at all. He's a great guy. Really? Yeah, I can't imagine who decides he wants to be a teenager, a wrestling coach for a bunch of teenage boys. Yeah, I'm sure there's nothing to suspect there at all. Yeah, that's my life's calling, man. That's what I'm going to do in my life. Teach wrestling. So, Dennis Hastert raping this kid for years. And then guess what? The kid goes on to die of AIDS. I mean, who knows if he was even gay at all before Dennis Hastert raped him numerous times. And then he got AIDS and died. And then Dennis Hastert showed up at his funeral. And the sister got in his face and screamed at him and all this and that. What a creep. That's what America is. That's what our institutions are here. Here in America, where we have the rule of law, where ambition is made to counteract ambition. We have child rapists for our House speakers. We have the most corrupt, most murderous people, the most ambitious people, with no real check or balance on them at all. He got away with this for years. Well, he was a government school teacher. He's got the whole union behind him and everything. And now, whoever he was paying the hush money to, that was some other boy that he raped, apparently. He wasn't paying hush money to this girl. She tried to get her story out before, but she couldn't corroborate it. I'm not exactly sure how it is they're saying it's, further corroborated now, other than now there's a story that he did this to somebody else, too. Boy, we already knew he was corrupt and an agent of a foreign power without registering as such. Lobbying for Turkey. But there you go. Dennis Hastert, child rapist. Serial child rapist. I wonder how many victims he's left behind him. Alive or dead. And I just mean his personal victims. I don't mean all the people who have had to suffer because of all the laws he passed as House Speaker. That's almost incalculable, right? And the resolutions, too. Not just the laws. And damned resolutions. Dennis Hastert. Yeah, I don't care what the charges are. They got Al Capone on tax evasion. They'll get you on mail fraud for collecting junk mail out of your mailbox that they send you every day. They'll nail you for whatever they feel like, but we're supposed to cry that, all he did was take money out of his own bank account. That's not really a crime. All he did was lie to the FBI about it like it's sworn perjury, when it's not, but Nobody should have to go to prison for that. Yeah, nobody but Dennis Hastert, the child rapist, former House Speaker, who personally passed the Patriot Act, who himself passed the Patriot Act that made it a crime or enhanced the criminal penalties and definitions for withdrawing money from your own G-damn account. So, bury him under the Supermax prison. Where he belongs. Ah, he'll get away with it. He'll get away with molesting more young boys. He's not going to prison. He'll be a child rapist for the rest of his life. And the law will continue to protect him for the rest of his life. Although, I don't know, I wonder whether this is political. Maybe he raped the son of somebody in the Justice Department or, you know, the second cousin or something like that. And so there's a little bit of a political personal vendetta going on here. Because otherwise, how does a House Speaker get indicted for anything? You know what I mean? And not just because some ambitious young FBI agent wants to make a case. I don't think so. We all know there's no such thing as a rule of law around here. This has got to be a political vendetta of some kind. And what I'm grateful for. Let him burn. But I'm just saying, it's not like what's actually happening to him has anything to do with justice, only incidentally, if anything. And still it remains to be seen what will happen to him, right? Piece of crap. All right, cool. And then, hey, remember yesterday I was ranting and raving about, oh, by the way, great war coverage and stuff coming up in just a second here. But remember yesterday I was ranting and raving, as I sometimes do, that in previous terrorist attacks, you have FBI agents running around chasing their tails and trapping idiots in fake terrorism cases, where then you have real attacks. Like Hassan and the Fort Hood attack, like the Boston bombing. I neglected to mention the Faisal Shahzad and the Times Square attack of 2010. And maybe there's been one more I'm missing. Anyway, well then, somebody sent me a link yesterday to an interview that I didn't get a chance to listen to yet, but I'm going to. But it was an interview of Trevor Aronson, and it had a link to an article by Trevor Aronson that he wrote for Mother Jones back in 2013 after the Boston bombing. And guess what he did in there? He made the connection and the correlation between the entrapment of the stupid idiot in the remote control plane grenade attack on the Capitol building. Remember that? Only a government employee would come up with that crap to be their terrorist attack. For Christ's sake, man. Who are these goons? What kind of incentive structure are they under where their terrorist plots don't even have to be plausible on their face? Anyway, that was the Boston FBI. It was the Boston FBI that was busy setting that guy up. Right as they were not stopping the Tsarnaevs. Who the Russians said, hey, these guys are palling around with jihadists in Dagestan. You better look out for them. Only 6 months before, they try to fudge that. Oh, yeah, that too. But they try to pretend that, no, that was a year or two before. No, it wasn't. It was as recently as 6 months before. In the fall of 2012, that the Russians said, you better look out for this guy. And they didn't, because they were busy making money, man. They're busy making the FBI look good. They're busy scaring your mom with some fake Orange Alert crap. Oh, the terrorists, they're everywhere. But meanwhile, there's two of them. They kill three people, including a little boy. Never even got a chance to turn 10 years old. Because at the FBI, at the FBI, PR is job one. Boy, did I flub that line. Jesus Christ. Strike me down. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Hey, listen, if you like giving money to anti-war radio hosts, but you're bored of the same old monthly subscription by PayPal or gigantic donation every once in a while, sign up at patreon.com and you can donate per interview. I know I need to start saying that and also buy a transcript at the end of every interview, but I keep forgetting because, you know, whatever. They're both kind of new concepts, and I got to get in the habit. But it seems like if I can get, I don't know, just all of you to donate 2 bits or 50 cents each time I interview somebody, then yeah, pay off the wife's medical bills. You know, I don't know. I could continue to rent the house I'm living in. That would be great. So, also, let me mention real quick, too, that we're doing this raffle. I'm going to raffle off a vacation, a week's vacation to Costa Rica. Well, you got to fly there. But then your stay and 3 meals a day are free in the jungles of Costa Rica at this awesome thing that I'll end up telling you all about. And then you'll give me money, and then you'll have a raffle ticket, and then you will have a chance to win a vacation for two to Costa Rica to go and live in the jungle and swim in the river and have a bunch of fun. So, that will be coming up soon. You want to go to Costa Rica? You want a chance to go to Costa Rica? All right, cool. Well, so keep your ears peeled for that if you like Costa Rica things. Hey, maybe I can get new listeners that way where people actually just put Costa Rica first, and then, oh, yeah, I got to listen to some anti-war crap to be, get a chance to win, huh? All right. All right. Yeah, so I think that's all the business I got to say about that. James Carden coming up on the show to talk about the Cold War with Russia and the politics of what the hell is going on in Ukraine right now. But now check this out. There's a guy named Micah Zenko. You know, I really should interview him. I was going all back and forth about whether I should interview him or not. I should have just sent him the email. Maybe I'll get around to it someday. I guess today would have been the good day to do it. But anyway, get this. So Micah Zenko, he writes for the Council on Foreign Relations. He's the Douglas Dillon Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, which you may be familiar, is the oldest and most prestigious and among the most dangerous think tanks, foreign policy think tanks in Washington, D.C., well, and in New York City before that, founded at the end of World War I by the Morgan Bank partners, basically, to set up the American Empire and their control of the American State Department as best they could. And so it's the reliable, realistic center of the American imperial foreign policy establishment. That's what it is. But Micah Zenko, as best I can tell, in fact, I read an article about him that said he's not just an anti-interventionist. He's a pacifist. And I think what they meant in a way were like if you slapped him, he would say, hey, listen, please don't do that kind of thing. He just doesn't like to fight. He's just a principled, peaceful guy. How in the hell did he get a job at the Council on Foreign Relations? I have no idea. Before that, he was at the Harvard something something. But I've never read him, and I have not read all the things he's ever written. But I've never read him saying that the government should do anything bad to anyone. I've seen him only, you know, sometimes gently ask kind of rhetorical questions, but I've seen him only oppose American policies. I've never seen him say, well, this would be all right if only they would do this instead of that. Or whatever. I haven't seen anything like that. I mean, what can I say? I think I like this Council on Foreign Relations guy. He seems pretty decent. And geez, with a position like the Dylan fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, he ought to be able to get on the Sunday morning news shows at least every once in a while, you'd think. Well, check it out. John Brennan was on Face the Nation yesterday, or not yesterday at all, I'm a few days behind here. Last Sunday, CIA director John Brennan was on there. And so, well, they're talking about, so what's going to be the deal with the Islamic State? And here's John Brennan's answer. I've been involved in this administration in different capacities for the last 6.5 years, and there's been a full court effort to try to keep this country safe. Dealing with some of these problems in the Middle East. Oh, they're asking, is Obama just putting this off for the next guy? That's what Schaefer asked him. And he says, dealing with some of these problems in the Middle East, whether you're talking about Iraq, Iran, Syria, Yemen, Libya, others. These are some of the most complex and complicated issues I've seen in my 35 years working on national security issues. So there are no easy solutions. Again, this is CIA Director Brennan, John O'Brennan, on Face the Nation. And then he says, I think the president has tried to make sure that we're able to push the envelope when we can protect the country. But we have to recognize that sometimes our engagement and direct involvement will stimulate and spur additional threats to our national security interests. And what's funny about that is, yeah, we all know that, except we don't. We don't have any policies based on this. We don't have an official consensus in media or in policy circles that this is the truth at all. And the other thing is, don't you just want to smack the bastard for the way he says it? Sometimes our engagement and direct involvement will stimulate and spur additional threats. I'm surprised he even used the word threats to our national security interests. For God's sake, cut the jargon. Cut the government executive branch, national security branch, newspeak, crap. CIA creates America's enemies. That's what he's trying to say. Whether we're directly backing our enemies or whether we're trying to fight them, all we ever do is make our enemies stronger. All we ever do is make them multiply. Sometimes our engagement and direct involvement will stimulate and spur additional threats to our national security interests. Ugh. Anyway, so here's the point. You might have guessed the point. And you know what? I really should have invited Zenko on the show, because then I would have spent at least half the interview beating him over the head with this point, trying to get him to acknowledge this point. That America started it. The war on terrorism didn't start after September 11th. And geez, some of our policies, as well-meaning as we've been, mistakes have been made. but, you know, some of the collateral consequences and blowback and other consequences going forward from what we've done in reaction to what happened to us. Well, you know, we're trying to learn and do better and eventually win, but you got to do what you got to do kind of thing. That's the unsaid, unspoken kind of premise behind all this. That, well, we're trying. And maybe Zenko's right about some of these policies, that they're counterproductive. But, you know, we're working on it. And what are we going to do? Nothing. So we got to try. But nobody ever admits that. You know, Ramzi Youssef wrote a letter to the New York Times. He said, the reason I bombed your tower, and he was trying to knock over one tower into the other in the late afternoon. Imagine, it would have been 20,000 people killed or more or something, right? And then, you know, the second tower, too, they would have both fallen into whatever other surrounding buildings as well. I mean, that would have been a massacre upon massacres. Can you imagine when Bill Clinton had been in office for a month and a day? A month and a week. And so thank God that attack failed. Holy crap. 6 people were killed, and that was horrible for them, but holy moly. But Ramzi Youssef wrote a letter to the New York Times, and he said, the reason I did it is because you're bombing Iraqis and killing them in the war, and you're still bombing them and killing them and blockading them, and you support the Israeli occupation of the Palestinians. And so how do you like it? That was what he said in his letter to the New York Times in 1993. Now, that doesn't mean he was right.
You know, the World Trade Center tower wasn't the Death Star, for Christ's sake. You know, these guys are sick, evil, civilian, butchering terrorists. They've got the morals of a Democrat. They're perfectly happy to kill however many women and kids. The price is worth it to them. I'm not saying they're in the right, but I'm saying let's not pretend that the Middle East invaded and occupied North America, and that's what got this war started. It was H.W. Bush and the first Gulf War. And his failure to put Israel in line. And everybody knows it. So stop pretending it ain't so. Oh, and I mean Bill Clinton, you know, through the whole 90s there, obviously, price worth it reference there. Yeah. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, y'all, back to the show. So, yeah, back to John Brennan's admission here, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency's admission that America's intervention overseas creates additional threats to our national security interests. That's right. And I cited there for you Ramzi Youssef in his letter to the New York Times after the first World Trade Center bombing, which, by the way, yes, it's an extremely important footnote. It's kind of beside the point here, but you should know that, yes, the FBI could have stopped that. And they actually had an informant come to them who made sure that he got the job as the bomb cook and came to them and said, man, these guys are serious terrorists. And give me a little bit of money and I'll help you stop this attack. They were only paying him $300 a week. He wanted $5 and wanted him to wear a wire. And he said, I'm sleeping on the floor of the mosque with these guys. I'm not wearing a goddamn wire, dude. And then so they basically canned him. They refused to give him $500 instead of $300 a week for this work. And so he told the guys, hey, I think the FBI's on to me. I got to get the hell out of here. And left the group. And so they brought in Ramzi Youssef, the real terrorist, to be the bomb cook, the nephew of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And he's the guy who ended up building the bomb and killing 6 people and almost succeeding in killing maybe a couple of 10,000 people. I guess they would have had to call off the Waco raid if that had happened, right? Anyway, what a different world we'd live in. So, but then after that, look, Egyptian Islamic Jihad / the Azzam group, which merged together and became Al-Qaeda, they've been attacking the United States ever since 2003, too. Really, their first attack in the United States was in 1989 when they assassinated the, fascist Israeli rabbi Kahane, who would no longer be beyond the pale in Israel right now. He would probably be the prime minister right now if he was still alive, I guess. He used to be considered completely beyond the pale over there. His party was outlawed. But things change. Anyway, but then there were all kinds of attacks all through the 1990s, and they said exactly what they were doing. And bin Laden put out his fatwa and did interviews with CNN and ABC News in 1996, who said exactly why he was doing what it was that he was doing. And, so all that's a fact, and it's also a fact that a senior officer on the joint staff told State Department counterterrorism director Michael Sheehan that he had heard terrorist strikes against the United States characterized more than once by colleagues, again, at the Pentagon joint staff, as, quote, a small price to pay for being a superpower. They knew it good and well. And guess who else knows it good and well? the Council on Foreign Relations. Hell, they had a whole thing with Gary Hart where they were recommending a new Department of Homeland Security to protect from domestic terrorist attacks before 9/11 ever happened over there. And, you know, where you can think back on the 1990s maybe and just think, you know, Homer Simpson and Crystal Pepsi and Jerry Seinfeld and peacetime. Hey, over there, the publishers of Foreign Affairs? No, they're paying attention. They knew about, and in some cases were, the neocons who were pushing for further and worse intervention in Iraq all through the 1990s, et cetera, et cetera. Who knew good and well about the blowback? Who read many of them, bin Laden's fatwas against the United States, etc. And now, so here's, I guess I'm your footnote. I can't find the footnote anywhere. It must be in a book that I read rather than an article I read online. Which really annoys me because I can't remember what book it was and I can't find anybody else on Twitter or anything apparently who knows this. If you know this footnote, please help me find it. But I know I'm right about this because it got stuck in my brain somehow, and which means I judged that it was real and not BS at the time that I took it on, which is flawless, basically, right there, whether I remember the damn thing or not. And there's ain't no way I could have got it confused. It was Lloyd Benson, Walter Mondale's attempted vice presidential candidate back in 1984. Oh, no. Dukakis, no, screwed that up, right? It was Dukakis' running mate in 88, right? Dukakis Benson? Was it Mondale Benson? Oh, yeah, it was Mondale Ferraro. Dukakis Benson. Ran with Dukakis in 88. He was the conservative Democrat senator from Texas. And he warned George H.W. Bush in 1990, don't put the troops in Saudi Arabia if you can avoid it. Because you're going to drive the fundamentalists there crazy, man. It's going to be a real problem. Bush Sr. was warned about that by Lloyd Benson before he ever done did it. So, when John Brennan says, yeah, sometimes the things we do cause the things that happen to us, yeah, that's right. And guess what else, too? History did not begin on September 11th, 2001. And America was intervening over there long before Arab terrorists ever were attacking the United States. As simple as that. And by the way, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is guilty of high treason. I mean, what is this? Am I living in the Twilight Zone here? For Christ's sake. I remember long before I ever read Raimondo, that was my shtick, bizarro world, where the sun is red and Superman's bad guy, and Janet Reno, the murderer, is actually the Attorney General of the United States of America. What in the world? This is crazy. But then, you know, Romano never heard me say that. And then it turned out that was his shtick, the bizarro world thing. And I'd already probably worn it out back in Free Radio Austin days in the 90s, so screw it. But boy, if this ain't bizarro world, I don't know what to call it. The future of Assad does not run through... Jesus, Horton... The future of Syria doesn't run through Assad, says the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey. In other words, America's policy in Syria is still regime change against the secular fascist minority coalition government there. In favor of the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. And they can try to pretend they just want to back the moderates, but guess who said that that was a lie? The president of the United States. He told Tom Friedman, look, man, the theory that there was ever going to be an army of moderates made up of a bunch of doctors and lawyers and pharmacists and like in the propaganda, that was always a fantasy. It was never going to happen. It was a fantasy, said the president. Okay, so where does that leave us? That leaves us with a civil war with the secular fascist dictatorship of Assad, which is backed by a majority of the population of Syria because it is a coalition of all the non-jihadi Sunnis, about half the Kurds, all the Christians, all the Druze, all the Shiites, all the Alawites. They all back the dictatorship, because it's the only thing standing between them and a good beheading, which brings us, well, back to Dempsey's treason. He's just guilty of treason. The whole goddamn government is guilty of treason. I mean, what can he do? John Brennan, Barack Obama, Dempsey, and unlike you or me, these guys have sworn allegiance to the state. They have sworn to uphold the document that is the charter of the government that they're operating under. This isn't like a Lysander Spooner moment where I don't owe you any allegiance, so how in the hell could I possibly be guilty of treason? Screw you. This isn't one of those, because they do owe allegiance. And they are guilty of aid and comfort to the enemy. It's just as simple as that. It's just as pure and simple as that. There's just no other way to put it. And I'm not saying that Obama's a secret Muslim. That's stupid. What he is he's a secret white guy. He's a half-white, conservative, corporatist, nationalist, imperialist. He's Ronald Reagan is who he is. He's George W. Bush is who he is. And although, you know, when Bush was backing the Iranians in Iraq, that wasn't really treason. It was a stupid policy and it had a lot of terrible consequences. But the Iranians aren't really our enemy. I mean, it's a horrible regime, but they're not really the enemy. And when he did back them, he accidentally turned all of Western and Northwestern Iraq into Jihadistan for the last 12 years straight, which was success beyond bin Laden's wildest dreams. The hoped for but unexpected gift to bin Laden was that regime change war, said Michael Scheuer, the former chief of the CIA's bin Laden unit, who was not a liar. But Obama's outright taken their side in Libya and still in Syria. And even after he admits there are no moderates, the FSA moderates, that's just a myth. That's a fantasy. But it's still his policy to back them against Assad. In other words, for Al-Qaeda and their break off ISIS. Hey, y'all, run out and get a copy of Embedded Alive. First-Person Journalism in the United States of America, 2013 through 14 by Chris Braswell. The book takes a gonzo look at daily life in America. Columns, informational letters, and other marketplace vigilance. A look at drug abuse culture and its marketing. And a series of contemplative and metaphysical essays. Get Embedded Alive, First-Person Journalism in the United States of America, 2013 through 14 in paperback, hardcover, and digital formats at fusepowder.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. All right, so anyway, I'm sorry for skipping ahead. I shouldn't skip ahead. I should just make it clear. The Soviet Union got out of the way, and then, as George Carlin said, I just couldn't wait for the Cold War to be over so we can go play with our toys in the sand and stay. Not just occupy the Arabian Desert in order to bomb the crap out of Iraq to force them out of Kuwait, but then they stayed. Contrary to Dick Cheney's promise to the king. And, they had new excuses to stay. No fly zone, endless blockade and sanctions and UN inspections, and the policy of dual containment instead of offshore balancing. And, so America had to continue, America had to be kept from ever having a rapprochement with Iraq or Iran. And the way to do that was to keep the bases and the policy of dual containment, which was a policy dreamt up by a bunch of lacudniks in the Clinton administration. Funny how Israel's interest sometimes is, all the time contrary to the interests of the people of this country. And, so America invaded, stayed, kept bombing the crap out of them, and turned our friends, the old Mujahideen from the Afghan War, into our enemies. They attacked us through the 1990s. including the Khobar Towers attack in 1996, which they blamed on Iran, again, because that's what Israel wanted. They blamed it on Iran, and they said it was Iranian-backed Saudi Hezbollah that did it, when it was Osama that did it. And you can take that to the bank, too. That's on Gareth Porter's reporting and Michael Scheuer's complaints about the politics behind the FBI, Louis Freeh, and the FBI blaming it on the Iranians. And then, of course, there were the Africa Embassy attacks and the coal. And but after the Africa Embassy attacks, Bill Clinton bombed Sudan, and that bombed a pharmaceutical plant there, antibiotics and anti-malarial disease medicine plant, which had the unintended or who cares result. Chomsky and some, Sam, argued about this recently, had the result of killing tens of thousands of people. And you'd hear Republicans say, oh, Bill Clinton sent some cruise missiles to bomb an aspirin factory, as though the problem was he should have invaded Sudan. And all he did was this limp-wristed little thing by bombing some meaningless little aspirin factory, pretending that it was a chemical weapons factory, when, no, it was pumping out extremely important anti-malarials and antibiotics, and it led to the death of tens of thousands of innocent people in sub-Saharan Africa. But not like a conservative Republican care about that. But anyway, what he also did was he shot a bunch of cruise missiles at the empty side of a mountain at some training camps in Afghanistan, and really made a folk hero out of Osama, and made it that much harder for the Taliban to get rid of him. Because now he basically had as much political capital as they did, being, you know, the survivor of an attack by a failed attack by the American imperialists. So that just made matters worse as far as that goes. And then, of course, after September 11th, you have the war in Afghanistan, which Bush and Obama both have spread into Pakistan. And then you have, again, the hoped for but unexpected gift to bin Laden, the invasion of Iraq and the destruction of the fascist dictatorship there. And then from there, it's the fighters from that war. Just like bin Laden and his guys were the leftover Mujahideen from Ronald Reagan and the CIA's Afghan war against the Soviet Union in the 1980s. Well, these were the guys who were the leftovers from Iraq War II. And what do? They went home to Libya and they started a war, and then Obama took their side. He took their side in a war against Libya, and then he turned right around and ran a rat line, right? That's Seymour Hersh all about it, the red line and the rat line. And there's new information coming out about this all the time, of course, where the CIA and their allies were running guns and jihadis out of Libya. As soon as they got rid of Gaddafi, they were running these weapons straight to Syria to push the jihad there. And now, you know, I used to think, geez, man, they couldn't have predicted, and they didn't, they surely couldn't have meant for their support for the Mujahideen in Syria to get this out of hand, where they roll into Mosul and create an Islamic State and everything, and then blam, now come out the DIA documents that we have this guy, Alistair Crook, the former MI6 official, is giving, you know, much credence and legitimacy to the importance of this DIA document that Judicial Watch got. One on the Libya rat line, but the other on just, it's a DIA analysis of the consequences of their policy of America and its allies. They don't mention Israel, but they're in there. Israel, Turkey, Saudi, Qatar, supporting the Mujahideen rebellion against Assad, the Sunni-based insurgency, as it were, against Assad in Syria, and how Al-Qaeda in Iraq is back. And they want to carve out a new Islamic State, and that's what they're going to do. An Islamic Sunni principality, a separate, they're going to break Syria apart. And the consequences for Iraq are that they might go right back to their old haunts in Mosul and Ramadi. And of course, they could have said Fallujah. Fallujah's the one that fell the Islamic State first by 6 months, actually. But there they are predicting that, yeah, in fact, you could actually end up creating the Islamo-fascist caliphate. And yeah, the allies, which includes us, we're doing this
to weaken Assad. And why? Because as Obama told Jeffrey Goldberg, because weakening Assad is a great way to weaken Iran. And why does Iran need weakening? Because we invaded Iraq and gave the southern two-thirds of it to them. So now the redirection. And never even mind side issues like the Mujahideen in Libya beating Gaddafi's forces, some of whom were hired mercenaries of the Tuareg tribes of northern Mali, who then took their guns and went home and decided autonomy wasn't good enough. They wanted full independence from the south and declared secession and went to war, and they were winning. And that caused a coup in the south where the sort of pseudo kind of democratic government there was overthrown by the colonels for failing to prevent the secession of the north. And then the jihadis came down from Libya, beat the Tuaregs again, basically, marginalized them, hijacked their whole rebellion, and went to war against the south, which led to Hillary tried to get the Algerians to do something about it, but they wouldn't. But she finally, once the Mujahideen started getting as far south down into the southern parts of Mali, finally the French intervened there. And not that they're all gone. And the northern part of Mali is the size of Texas, which is huge, by the way. That's why the cliche about how big Texas is. And the Mujahideen are running wild and lawless desert Texas-sized territory there in Mali. And in fact, there's been real journalism about this. I know this sounds like stupid war propaganda playing, oh, this Mujahideen, you know, played monkey bars with that Mujahideen, and so they're, now they're all the same. But there's real reporting about the Bin Ladenites who came down to northern Mali meeting up with the Boko Haram guys, the bark-eating crazies from the backwoods of... Yes, I'm plagiarizing that from Spalding Gray and Swimming to Cambodia, if you're not familiar with that cool thing. But they're the bark-eating crazies from the backwoods of Nigeria, and then they went up to Mali, and they got training in tactics and in ideology. And they got actual weapons, shoulder-fired missiles and more machine guns and whatever. They went back to Nigeria worse than they ever were before. That's what John Brennan means when he says this is all his goddamned fault. Read it and weep today at the Council on Foreign Relations website, at Micah Zenko's blog. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. All right, so check this out from the Times of Israel staff. That's a sort of right-leaning news source there in Israel. In very rare public meet, Israeli-Saudi officials name Iran as common foe. Guess where? At the Council on Foreign Relations. We've not resolved all our differences. Well, gee, the Saudi peace plan for the two-state solution is perfectly reasonable, and that's been decades. So if the Israelis wanted to deal and have outright recognition from all of the neighboring states, including Iran, too, well, then they could have that. So no wonder all their differences aren't resolved, because the Israelis are just a bunch of land rustlers, so that's all. They're not going to give up the West Bank. But anyway, we've not resolved all our differences, but we hope to, says Dor Gold. Two countries have held five secret meetings since 2014, claims Bloomberg, and that is Eli Lake, although seems like he has this on pretty good authority, and it's, you know, it's not like he's trying to lie us into war with it kind of thing, I don't think. But yeah, definitely look at Eli Lake askance when you read what he writes. And if you don't believe that, go back and look at his record seriously. Okay. You'll be laughing your ass off, actually.
But so, yeah, man, they were, they gave back-to-back speeches. It was Dore Gold, who was, who is the incoming director general of the Israeli Foreign Ministry. And he shook hands with a retired Saudi general who is a former top advisor to the Saudi government, but I guess presumed to be able to speak for them more or less, Dore Gold and Anwar Eshki. They both espoused Israeli-Saudi peace and identified Iran as the chief threat to regional stability. So, you know, there you go. No hiding it anymore. Might as well go ahead and claim it. And, you know, Pat Buchanan says today, Pat Buchanan cites Michael Oren saying, well, we prefer the Sunni bad guys to the Shia bad guys. And Pat Buchanan says, yeah, well, that's nice, except the Sunni bad guys are the ones who have the blood of 3,000 of our countrymen on their hands. How is anyone arguing with a straight face that America ought to be backing the Bin Ladenites just because their enemies are Hezbollah? Who gives a crap about Hezbollah? Hezbollah doesn't attack America. Hezbollah is not an enemy of America. Hezbollah wouldn't even exist if it wasn't for Israeli war crimes and occupation in Lebanon back in the 1980s. They were Israeli allies before Israel. I mean, the Shiites of Lebanon were Israeli allies when the Israelis invaded. But then they stayed and treated everybody like crap and tortured and murdered and abused them. And so they created the Party of God to oppose the occupation. Sound familiar? But they're not America's enemy. But, oh, so boo-hoo, Iran, which is not making nukes, gives support to Assad, which is no threat, even really conceivable threat to Israel, his regime in Syria, and to Hezbollah, which is basically a glorified militia in southern Lebanon, right? Which is a, you know, sort of a pseudo mini state. It's like a corporation or something, you know, there in southern Lebanon. But that's why American policy is so backwards. You know, our current Vice President Joe Biden has been quoted as saying, you can find the video of this actually saying, there will never be any daylight, no daylight, no daylight between America's policy and Israel's policy. Well, but what happens when their allies are our enemies? If we have, you know, we have no legitimate state enemies on the face of this earth. Our only enemies are the terrorist groups that rise up to fight us because we are allies with the governments of the countries that they're from. They're the only enemies we got. And here we are, we're backing them in Syria. Backing them, you know, too. But only why? Because that's what the Israelis and the Saudis and the Turks want? When these guys are still sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York City? Boy, I thought I was tired of debunking the Iranian nuclear weapons program. I can't believe I have to keep making the case against supporting the al-Nusra Front. You know? What in the world is this? It's that's part of being an empire, man. It's for sale to the highest bidder. You know? All this would make a lot more sense if there really was, you know, some kind of secret committee that decided it all. But if there is a secret committee, they're all a bunch of foreigners. And really, it's not. It's squeaky wheel gets the grease. That's all it is. So, you know, why do we fight for Iran in Iraq, but against Iran in Syria? That is, against the Bin Ladenites in Iraq, but for them in Syria? Well, because that's what the various lobbies insist on to various degrees and the various bureaucrats who are allied with them and their negotiations of what they're going to do. And here we are making a de facto peace treaty with Iran. Obama comes out and denounces the status quo and says we must have an Iran deal. Sanctions against Iran can't last forever, he says. This is from the same interview where he talked about the Palestinian state issue that we talked about on the show yesterday. Where, look, the EU and the United Nations, they're going to lift their sanctions, okay? So the crippling sanctions, the noose we got around Iran, it's a temporary thing. and we're trying to use it to get them to agree to our terms, and now you guys want to sabotage that, don't do it. And by the way, he says, there is no military option. Can you imagine? The president admitted that this is the case. If we bomb them, that'll just make sure that they try to make nukes, and then we'll have no other solution except to just keep bombing them. But who the hell is going to invade Iran? Nobody. So there is no guarantee of a regime change. I guess if you dropped an H-bomb on Tehran, that might take care of it, but I don't think they're probably willing to go that far. And so what are you doing, man? They have a civilian program. We want to double extra super, make sure that it stays that way. And so let's agree to these terms and push forward here. The reasonable case Obama's making to make peace with Iran. But then, of course, he can't do that without being twice as bad in the other direction. Now, instead of being, enemies with Iran, we're going to go back to the George W. Bush policy of fighting for them in Iraq. I mean, at least he's not fighting for them in Syria, but he shouldn't be fighting against them in Syria either. That's even worse, really. But yeah, and then by the way, you gotta know this. I'm gonna interview this Sina Tusi. I've talked with him before. The Bomb Iran lobby gears up for 2016. It's all about Sheldon Adelson, and again, the special interests that dictate American foreign policy. Oh, crap, I'm almost out of time. Hey, read this. You can read a couple free a month. It's at Foreign Policy, The Great Iranian Low-Enriched Uranium Stockpile Panic of June 2015. It's by Jeffrey Lewis, debunking Broad and Sanger and all the hype. And we'll be right back with James Carden in just a minute. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our guest today is James Carden. He's a contributing editor to the American Conservative Magazine and also writes for the National Interest. Here he has a piece for the Liberal Nation magazine, Neo-McCarthyism and the U.S. Media. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, James?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us on the show today. Lots of important stuff to talk about. First and foremost, I'd like to give you a chance to tell us about this new organization that you have apparently helped to found here, the American Committee. Boy, I'm tripping over my own tongue here. The American Committee for East-West Accord. What's that?
Well, it's sort of a it's new, but it has a very distinguished predecessor. The old American Committee on East-West Accord was a Cold War pro-détente organization made up of illustrious Americans who were taking a stand against the more hard-line crowd centered around the old Committee for the Present Danger. Now, the old committee was made up of people like George F. Kennan, former Under Secretary of State George W. Ball, Hodding Carter from the Johnson administration, former Senator George McGovern, and others. And so today we thought that given the nature of the one-sided nature of the debate over U.S.-Russia policy that has been occurring since the start of the Ukraine crisis, it was perhaps appropriate to revisit this committee and get more pro-détente, pro-dialogue voices out there, aside from the usual neocon militarists who have dominated the debate over the past 18 months.
You know, I'm curious about how different the debate is, James, compared to then. I mean, I remember watching, say, I don't know, Crossfire or whatever with my dad in the 80s when I was a little kid.
And it seemed like at least there was a longer period of time between commercials, and the discussion was just seemingly on the surface more serious. It was almost like, well, you know, we lied to you all week long, but on Sunday morning, the discussion is based on a little bit more reality kind of thing. But it doesn't seem like that anymore to me, but that may have just been because I was a little kid and it all seemed more on the up and up and I didn't understand. But, in other words, in the 70s, did reasonable voices have a much more prominent voice than they have now? Was it any easier to push back against the echo chamber of the crazies?
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, I think that if you, one can easily look up the membership of the old committee on East-West Accord, and see that the members of that committee came from represented a broad spectrum of American political thinking. You had, you know, Avril Harriman, who was the former governor of New York and the former ambassador to the USSR, standing alongside Theodore Herzberg, who was the president of Notre Dame. These voices, these pro-détente voices, were very much in the mainstream. There are some similarities, I think, to the debate then, debate now, especially in terms of the tactics that neoconservatives use. I'll give you an example that I came across that I find by turns amusing and disturbing. The old Committee on the Present Danger, this neoconservative organization that I've been speaking about, issued this in 1977. See if this sounds familiar. The Soviet military buildup of all its armed forces over the past quarter century is in part reminiscent of Nazi Germany's rearmament in the 1930s. Well, this is very similar to the parallels that are made almost without surcease between Vladimir Putin's Russia and Nazi Germany. And so, you know, I think that one of the differences between the debate now and the debate then, though, is that the hardline anti-Russian pro-militarist crowd has very quickly descends into ad hominem, and that was part of the focus of the Nation article that you mentioned earlier.
Right, because, you know, I don't know, I guess, well, it's easier than engaging in an actual argument. We're basically dealing with the Serge Wirt level nonsense when it comes to the rise of Putin's imperialist Russia here. It's what Robert Higgs calls truncating the antecedents. All you need to know is that Putin may have given some guns and some money to some rebels in eastern Ukraine. That monster. It's just like that time that Hitler moved into Czechoslovakia, where it doesn't matter that it's nonsense. It's just as long as you got, you know, at least five or six different editorial pages pushing the same narrative, it passes for wisdom, I guess.
Yeah.
As long as it's conventional, it's wise.
That's exactly right. I mean, there's basically been this extraordinary conflation between the right, the traditional rights, neoconservatism, and the Democratic Party's liberal interventionists. Those philosophies are now basically one and the same. And so what many of the pundits and even government officials do is, rather than debate on the merits, what they do is they'll say, well, the position that you're taking, right, on, say, NATO expansion. Well, people on RT say the same thing. Therefore, you must be a Putin apologist, and we're not going to engage you on the issues. We're just going to say that you're disqualified from the conversation because what you're saying also happens to be what they're saying on Russian state media.
Yeah.
That's a very clever way to circumvent a debate. But it is noxious, and it is reminiscent of the worst aspects of the McCarthy era.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and, you know, and also, you know, it's a
also
lie.
It's a
I mean,
lie.
That's the thing. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, James, could you turn your speakers down just a little bit? Maybe I think that'll help. That's the whole other thing, is it's just not true. And I was just reminded the other day about when George Kennan spoke to Tom Friedman in 1998 of the New York Times there about NATO expansion. He was basically screaming at the top of his lungs, as far as that kind of thing goes, saying, don't do this. That, you know, you claim that this is perfectly benign and there's no way the Russians will see this as some kind of threat. But yes, they will too. And there's no reason to do this. And we're doing it to the guys who overthrew the communists for us. So what the hell are we doing here? Stop. And they did it anyway.
They did it anyway. And then Kennan predicted what would happen afterwards. He said that, you know, Russia would react. And then the proponents of the policy would claim that because the Russians have reacted, that it vindicates their expansionist policy. And so, you know, it just goes round and round. It's striking to me. And I think that it's one of the reasons why reforming the committee is so timely, is because voices like Kennan's have been marginalized. And so I think it's extremely important, given what's going on in eastern Ukraine right now, where the fighting seems to be on the verge of a new conflagration over there. I think it's extraordinarily important.
Right. And by the way, for people not familiar, Kennan was one of the creators of the Cold War doctrine in the first place. At the dawn of the Cold War after World War II. So he is no slouch when it came to opining on these issues. I'm sorry, we'll be right back on the other side of this break with James Carden from the American Conservative and the National Interest in just a minute. Hey, all, Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with James Carden. He is from the American Committee for East-West Accord, the brand new group. He's putting together as many heavy hitters as he can to plead for a little bit of sanity, at least some realism in the discussion about what the policy is, what the facts are in Eastern Europe right now, and what can be done to keep the peace here. How are we ever going to get things right if we don't even have the facts straight? So here's the thing. It's very important, I think, James, that you write for the National Interest, which is different from what you heard during the commercial, folks. The Council for the National Interest Foundation is a separate organization, even though their names are somewhat similar. So you write for them. You write for the American Conservative Magazine. And it's very important, even though communism has been dead in Russia for 25 years, it's very important still that you come from the right and you make a conservative argument rather than something that can be spun as just some kind of liberal Nation magazine, Michael Moore, give peace a chance, naive and not tough enough, you know, like they say about Obama, no matter how many people he kills, not tough enough to stand up against the vile Vladimir Putin, that kind of thing. So it seems, extremely important to me that you are a part of this from the very beginning and that you continue to bring on as many conservatives. I see you have Jack Matlock, George H.W. Bush's second to last ambassador to the Soviet Union, as a member as well. And I would just hope that you continue to focus on bringing as many prominent conservatives on as you can. Even if, you know, Henry Kissinger has some reasonable things to say about Russia these days, which, I don't know if you want to associate yourself with him, but anyway, you see the drift I'm coming from here, because as you're saying, the narrative is dominated by, you know, basically a bunch of David Frummy and name calling, and there's no real engagement with the other side of the debate, which is as simple as, hey, let's just rewind the facts a couple of years, look at the overall policy and how we got into this mess, instead of starting with the taking of Crimea last spring.
That's right. I think you might be giving me a little bit too much credit. I'm an employee of the committee. I didn't created. It's very much the brainchild of who came together.
Oh, I'm sorry. There, I lost that.
And you're right, too. No.
I'm sorry, James. I lost that brainchild of.
Yeah, oh, as was.
Oh, no. Now we're having an internet problem here. Oh, it must be the Russians tapping our line. They're behind everything bad recently, I read in the National Review. I'm sorry. Try again. Let's see if that's any better. All right. I'll tell you what. I'm going to hit the red button, and I'm going to call back. You know, Skype is superior audio quality, but boy, does it come with its flaws, man. You rarely have that happen with plain old telephone service. Am I right? I guess sometimes. Oh, probably more often on Skype than on a cell phone, really, if you think about it. Oh, bandwidth. It's not on my end, is it? No, I don't think so. Chat room guys, mention if it's me or if it's not. I guess if you can hear me, then it's not. Call dropped. Can't get him. Let me try again. His symbol's still green, guys. Green symbol means try again. What a long, convoluted thing for me to say for him to have no answer after that. And especially when he was trying to give credit to the other people who organized the thing. Bill Bradley, huh? That's interesting. Oh, man, oh, man. You know, he's still all green. It's not white in the middle. It's a Skype problem. Hey, wait a minute. I have his phone number. I just need to... Oh, my sound bites are all pointing to the wrong folder right now. Oh, no. What am I going to do? I guess I could play some music. I guess I could just pipe in Al Jazeera audio for a minute. Let me be right back, y'all.
Coming up later tonight, hear more of their story. What brought them to this point? What was the desperation pushing them to make this dangerous risk? Heidi Jo Castro, Al Jazeera, Brooks County, Texas.
You can watch Heidi's full report from Texas tonight at 8. Coming up, an attempt to stop sea lions has failed in Oregon, and it involved that fiberglass whale. And fighting back against the Cleveland curse, some fans in Cleveland think their teams may never win a championship again.
We're here to fully get into the nuances of everything that's going on.
I am literally piping in Al Jazeera's commercials on my radio show right now. That is not okay. David Schuster, the plagiarist, is on Al Jazeera America now? I didn't know that. Oh, well, anyway. Listen, I got James Carden on the line, and we had a little bit of a Skype problem, but now I got him on the telephone. And I'm sorry, you were saying I gave you way too much credit for helping to organize the putting together of this American Committee for East-West Accord at eastwestaccord.com.
That's true. I'm very happy to be serving as the editor, but it's very much the brainchild of the founding board. It's a very distinguished bipartisan group in keeping with the tradition of the older committee. So we have regular contributors to The Nation, like Professor Cohen. I'm a pretty frequent contributor to The Nation myself. Former Democratic senator and presidential candidate, Bill Bradley, is on the committee. And we have distinguished businessmen like Gilbert Doctorow and former Disney chairman and Procter and Gamble chairman, John Pepper.
That's
a group
important.
With, distinguished businessmen, intellectuals, and the occasional hack journalist like myself. So it's
Is part of the plan to bring on as many prominent people as you can who are willing to stick their neck out and speak reasonably on this issue?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Let the word go forth.
Off the ground. Yes.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is scientifically, it's not even a matter of opinion. It's a mathematical fact that this is the most important thing in the whole wide world, America's relationship with Russia. We got thousands of H-bombs, thousands of them. So we just can't have this. We just can't have it. Simple as that.
I think that you know, having the neocons take over U.S.-Russia policy is an enormous mistake and poses an enormous danger to the country. I mean, there is no national security issue that involves the United States that doesn't have some bearing on U.S.-Russian relations. And that goes for the continuing operations in Afghanistan. It goes for the problem of Islamic terrorism in the Middle East. It goes for the tricky problem of what to do with North Korea, and never mind the security situation in Europe. And it even extends to outer space. After all, we are using or have been using Russian rockets, and we have been cooperating with them on the space station for many years now. Mm-hmm. So it's an extraordinarily important relationship, too important, I would say, to leave to the crowd of warmongers who inhabit many or most of the think tanks and political journals in this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, it seems, you know, like important maybe that back then when Kennan and the guys created the Cold War, they said, listen, this isn't just that Russia has a tremendously sized sphere of influence, that they're dominating all of Eastern Europe the way that they are, but it's that it's backed by this insane, murderous, communistic ideology that's hell-bent on world domination. And therefore, we got to contain them. We absolutely must wage this Cold War against them, even roll them back, argued the others, etc., regime change them. But so now we're talking about whether they're allowed to have their sphere of influence in, you know, right there. I mean, we already have the Baltic states as members of NATO, and now, obviously, as far as my best understanding, as far as any other foreign nation on the planet, Ukraine is the one that is most important to Russia, that it stay in their so-called orbit and doesn't go palling around with the likes of NATO, the opposition military alliance. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a certain irony in our current position. Back then, it was the USSR that had a kind of universalist ideology. We know well what that was. Russia today doesn't have a universalizing ideology, but we do, and it's called democratic peace theory, and it's this idea that we should be going around interfering with the internal affairs of other countries and remaking their governments in the image of our own. And we do that as Max Boot, the prominent neoconservative, has written, we should do that at gunpoint if need be. So crusading mentality used to belong to the Soviet Union, and now belongs to us. I find it very puzzling that there are numerous American commentators who now seem to have discovered Ukraine, and now suddenly Ukraine is as important to us as it is to Russia. Well, that's completely ludicrous. The Yale historian Timothy Snyder has written that there is no European future without Ukraine. Well, that's a preposterous thing to say, especially given the fact that I think only 18% of Americans can find Ukraine on a map. You're exactly right. This is an extremely fraught moment, and our pretending that Ukraine means as much to us as it does to Russia, never mind to the people in eastern Ukraine, is ludicrous.
All right. Well, so now maybe I should try to contradict and check my own confirmation bias here. I mean, I understand very well, I think I do, the role of America leading up to, creating the crisis in the European Union, our allies, creating the crisis in Ukraine that led to the coup d'etat, which they supported, and, much of America's intervention, how it led to this, beyond just NATO expansion in general, but leading up to the current crisis and the war going on in Ukraine right now. But in a sense, that kind of is beside the point of whether Putin is a reborn czar who's determined to move his border as far west as he possibly can. Maybe he does, despite the fact that America obviously picked this fight. We have Nuland's leaked phone call and all of this. What exactly, sir, do you know about Russia? And are you sure that you're not being naive, that I'm not being naive about the intentions of this vicious right-wing nationalist government that they have there, or communistic one, or whatever we're supposed to call it, to be afraid of it? Are you sure that it's all just propaganda here that's got everybody set on edge?
Well, in a sense, I am, because if you look at what the United States and NATO have been up to for the past 25 years, a very easy way to figure out what the Russians are thinking is just simply walk in their shoes for a moment and think back what has gone on from 1994 to 2014. And there's been the very steady, slow march of NATO installations and countries joining NATO, surrounding Russia. And the United States has made a concerted effort to gather up the former members of the Soviet Union and place them into our camp. And so it would look very different, I think, if Russia and China decided to start installing countries in, you know, Latin America, for instance, into the Shanghai Security Organization. That would look, I think, rather threatening from our shores. So I think that what explains Mr. Putin's stance in Ukraine has to do with it being it's a defensive operation. We hear these things all the time in the American press that if we don't stop him in eastern Ukraine, he's going to roll on into the Baltics, he's going to roll on through into Poland, etc. That really makes very little sense, and I think that there's absolutely very little to believe that. The reason that the war began in Ukraine has to do with the fact that Ukraine was going to join the EU, and then when a country joins the EU, almost inevitably what follows is that it joins NATO. In fact, there are specific security and foreign policy protocols embedded within the European Union Association Agreement that pave the way for NATO membership. So Russia, in a sense, was reacting in a defensive, not offensive manner. Now, does this excuse the fact that they are funding the rebellion and sending troops into the sovereign territory of Ukraine? It does not, but it's understandable. And I think that there's a big difference between explaining Russian behavior and excusing Russian behavior. But we have to try to understand where they're coming from, because the relationship is so important. And then we need to ask ourselves, are we going to commit U.S. blood and treasure over the Donbass? I find it very difficult to believe.
Yeah. Well, and of course, there's the double standard where America can back even Mujahideen rebels in Syria in the name of humanitarianism because of the war against them, which is really, you know, their war against the government, really, but whatever you call it. So I'm not sure it's altogether clear that it's morally wrong. I don't know about international law, where if the coup d'etat government in Kiev is determined to obliterate the people. I mean, this was the excuse for the war against Libya, right? Was, well, we got to protect the people in the east from getting killed.
Yeah, it's like burning. Yeah. It's like, you know, burning the village down to save it. You know, in the government that we are in bed with, this junta regime in Kiev, is enacting and has been enacting now for a year, almost a year now, about 13 months now, a so-called anti-terrorist operation against their own people. And I think that says a lot. And I've been to the Donbass. I went in late March, and the ordinary people there simply are in a state of disbelief that their own countrymen now view them as little more than terrorists. And so Kiev has done a horrific job in trying to keep the country together. In fact, you know, the way that they've gone about dealing with the rebellion has done nothing except exasperate the situation.
All right. Now, I'm sorry. Is there any way I can keep you for one more question? We're already over time here, and I don't want to cut in on your plans, but I got one more.
Absolutely.
Okay. So I wonder if you think then that this is the end of Minsk 2, which apparently, you know, had more teeth in it, was working a little better than Minsk 1. There's been some fighting, but now it's sort of, never mind the propaganda about, oh, the Russians are preparing for a full-scale invasion, but I wonder whether Kiev is, and I wonder whether you think, you know, Americans over there training are going to be caught in a tripwire or something like that, possibly?
I mean, that's one of the great dangers of sending American trainers. We recall the sending of American trainers very well in the previous war, right, in Southeast Asia. It began with a couple of hundred so-called advisors and trainers and then quickly spun out of control. So is this the end of Minsk 2? It's quite possible. Minsk 2 has been hanging by a thread. When I was in Donetsk in late March, the fighting around the airport continued, you know, the entire time I was there. There have been parts of the Donbass where the fighting really has never stopped. Part of the blame for this, and this never really gets mentioned, is that Minsk II required the government in Kiev to speak, to negotiate with the rebels and their representatives in the Donbass, in the two self-proclaimed People's Republics, the one in Luhansk and the one in Donetsk. And they refused to do so. And so that in itself is a violation of the Minsk Accords. And so if you're not willing to sit down and negotiate with these people, then war will come. And people will say, well, why should they negotiate with terrorists? Well, it happens all the time. And we wouldn't have peace in Northern Ireland if people didn't sit down with IRA and Sinn Féin. So, you know, we can't have this sort of, you know, utopian idea where, you know, we live in this world where we never negotiate, we never deal with terrorists. What should our priority be? To stop the fighting and stop the human suffering, which is immense in eastern Ukraine, or not. And I think that Kiev has made their choice. And I think the choice that they have made is to continue the anti-terrorist operation. So they have chosen war, and Russia will respond.
Yeah. And then, like you said earlier, quoting Kennan or paraphrasing Kennan, then they'll say, see, we told you 15 times that Russia was going to invade, and it finally came true.
That's right. Well, now, stop clock is right twice a day, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, but now, when Obama sends the trucks and sends the troops over there to train these guys, is that just politics? Because, geez, I got to try to get John McCain to shut up somehow? Or that's because he's deliberately trying to sabotage the peace treaty that obviously is not perfect, but so far had been more or less held by the leadership of each side, the one that the French and the Germans went in there and made, pushed Obama out of the way and made it. Is he deliberately trying to sabotage Merkel's plan here, do you think?
No, I don't. I think that the proof of that is that he sent John Kerry over to Sochi to meet with President Putin and Foreign Minister Lavrov. I don't think that the president is on board with this kind of transformative project. I think that he's a very bad manager. Now, I like the president, and I'm not. I'm really more kind of a centrist. I think that he has the good sense to know that sending in weapons and escalating this thing is going to draw a very brutal response from the Russians. And so I think that, yeah, I think that part of his motivation in sending the trainers is political. But I think that we're actually very fortunate that he is in the White House rather than someone like McCain, or rather than someone like Romney, who surrounded himself with the worst kind of neoconservative advisors. So, but I think that after Obama leaves office, all bets are off, because I don't see on the horizon any candidate that will stand up to the neocons or liberal interventionists, except maybe someone who doesn't really have a chance at becoming president, like Bernie Sanders. And I fear that Senator Paul probably doesn't have much of a chance either, but, you know, he probably wouldn't go along with this project either. But those are two in a field of, I don't know how many candidates there are now, almost 15 or so on both sides, 20, I don't know. So I think the prospects for peace in eastern Ukraine are not good.
All right, well, thanks very much for your time. You know, so far, I guess it could have been worse. I mean, if John McCain had been the president starting in 2009, we wouldn't have even lived to 2015 to have this conversation. We'd all died in a nuclear war with Russia a long time ago. So,
I'm
quite certain of that. I don't have any doubt of that. So, you're right. As far as things go, I guess we're pretty lucky here, James.
It's all relative.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, listen, thanks very much for your time. I sure appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott.
Good to talk to you again. That's James Carden, everybody. Writes at the American Conservative magazine. That's the anti-war right there, mostly. He's a centrist, as he says. Writes also for The National Interest and The Nation magazine as well. His latest there is called Neo-McCarthyism and the U.S. Media.